From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. Philadelphia-based writer and cultural critic Trey Johnson has sparked big conversations with his new book, Black Genius: Essays on an American Legacy.
When I personally picture genius, I was typically picturing like an individual, often a white man, who was doing something audacious and bold on his own. So for me, I wanted to just try to describe, like, what do I see Black genius as?
His book, Black Genius, explores creativity, identity, and the everyday brilliance found throughout Black life in America. Whether it's art and language, survival, or joy, Trey shares his personal story while giving critical thought to how people of color have found ways to transcend race, class, and caste. I sat down with Trey and started by asking him to explain the difference between Black genius and Black excellence.
Oh, man. Yeah, this has come up in conversations a bunch. For me, I see Black excellence much more embedded in a conversation around capitalism, much more like born out of like the Obama era, where like the floodgates seem to open around Black achievement, Black life. It's like very Martha's Vineyard coded to me in a certain type of way. And that stuff is great.
The talented 10.
Yes, yes. And look, I'm not trying to carve that out, but I think that's been a very limiting conversation that's left out a lot of the rest of us. So I talk about everything from flash mobs to dirt bike culture to t-shirts to a dunde. Like, those are the things that I think Black excellence tends to overlook because it's so much ladder climbing.
Or maybe even look down on.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Some of that uppity, you know, the Black excellence, talented 10th versus the genius that exists in all of us.
Totally. And I worry that it's a cudgel that gets used against Black folks who don't have those aspirations or have made it up the ladder in the same type of way.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something different.
And you weave your own personal story throughout these essays that you've written. And talk about your beloved uncle, Alan.
Yes.
And I have it sort of blocked out. It's page 45. It's from here and it goes to here. If you could read that section of your book.
I would love to. Thanks for asking me to read. Alan developed a kind of Black cultural woke genius, what he considered streamal, that reminds me of conscious rappers. He knows how to seamlessly blend hood politics, street knowledge, and academia. And he knows how to play it back in white people's faces with conversations that would freak them out with his combination of know-how and Trenton slick dude looks. He has the pedigree to back his thoughts up and would share the ways he was able to parse the world without a single hitch in his voice or his delivery. That's why streamal isn't code switching. Because with code switching, you kind of flip one part of yourself to adjust to a situation. You upspeak when maybe you don't normally in order to be heard. You draw your voice for dramatic effect to seem familiar with people. You whiten your voice to sound, quote, more intelligent. My uncle, Alan Johnson, for right or wrong, has a genius that looked at that switch and snatched it off the wall.
And so I want you to talk a little bit about your Uncle Alan and why you thought that he is someone who sort of epitomizes what Black genius stands for.
Yeah, I love my Uncle Alan dearly. He's my dad's youngest brother. He's a guy that grew up in Trenton in the 60s, went to public school, was too smart to fit into public schools as Trenton was able to kind of give him at that time. So he went to private school, Princeton Day School. And like a lot of us, I think, Black folks who have made it into other spaces while still being rooted in Black communities, he was bridging these two worlds. He would go to this elite private school all day, and he eventually went to University of Pennsylvania. But every time he went home, home was the block, you know, home was Trenton. And so for him, I think one of the things I wanted to highlight about what his genius is this idea of streamal that he came up with, which I think is like the opposite of code switching. So for him, it's about how does he keep the whole integrity of his person complete, regardless of what room or space or table that he's at. And that, I think, has given me, and I think other kids in the family, like this idea of permission, of like, you can be yourself and still be respected everywhere you go.
And I think that is something that a lot of people of color struggle with as you sort of transcend your caste or whatever group you're supposed to be in. And you go to these spaces, like your uncle went to University of Pennsylvania. He was in Ivy League schools. And he's in rooms that, you know, his ancestors would have dreamed of being
in.
But how do you maintain your authenticity? And you even struggled with that.
Oh my gosh, I did. You know, no shade to the great education career that I've had, but one of the things I talk about, I think you're alluding to, is I worked for Teach for America here in Philadelphia, and I was executive director for a couple of years. And it's hard. It's really hard when you're in the position in the big seat of fundraising. We had a $7 million budget.
You had to get this money.
And oh,
you had to talk.
God.
You had to go to rooms and with people who have that money.
For real. Yeah.
And how do you be yourself and talking to them and extracting those dollars?
And I made the choice not to be myself, right? Because I thought that that's what the job called for. I thought that was the right way to be like effective, was to like, you know, pantomime all these stories about Black folks here in the city, about lives and circumstances that were hard, that I was just like whoring to just get dollars from. And I think I turned off my values, turning off my perspective of sensitivity about other people's lives and circumstances.
But then one day you flipped the switch.
Oh my gosh.
You became you, but like an elevated version of you.
That is very kind of you to say. I mean, I think is, you know, I like to think back on that moment as a moment of clarity. Like, it's a deep moment of clarity, and it's a latent clarity that someone like my Uncle Alan had much earlier in life. Mm-hmm. For me, it just like all snapped into place. So yes, there's a moment that I write about in the book where I'm executive director for Teach for America, and I'm supposed to give a certain type of speech at our 10th anniversary gala.
And you had this speech written.
I had a speech written. It had been vetted by Teach for America's national staff, because they do not play around. So every T was crossed and every I was dotted. And I had rehearsed it. But then I got up on that stage, and I talk about this.
Didn't say any of that stuff.
I did not. I mean, I know this is a problematic reference to make nowadays, but you know, I say it's the closest thing to my version of like a Kanye when he does the telethon, and it's like George Bush doesn't care about Black people. I think a moment that a lot of us have where it's like, man, F this place. You know,
I'm gonna say the real. But yeah. People loved it. They embraced you.
I mean, not everyone in that room loved it that night. In the long tail of life, yes. In that moment, you know, a lot of folks in the crowd were like, you don't sit your behind down.
Yeah, you got in trouble a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. That turned out to be my grand goodbye at the same time, too. But I don't regret it. You know, I think, I wouldn't be the writer that I am now. I wouldn't be sitting here in the studio now. I wouldn't have had these other opportunities and those other permission to just tell truer, broader stories, and I just want to keep doing that now.
Yeah. And so I want to talk about your Philly chapter, because you live here now. You've been living here for almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years. Crazy.
So are you a Philadelphian yet?
Only if a Philadelphian tells me that.
Okay.
We know the rule.
You know the rule. Thank you.
Right.
We're on the same
page. Don't
try to
trick me in this interview.
We are on the same page. So I want to talk about Philly, because you devote a section of your book to Black art and celebration.
Yeah.
And the Black summer that happens here in Philly. One of the things you talk about is bike life culture.
Yeah,
and in the summer, I mean, folks hear dirt bikes. They roar down Broad Street.
Yeah.
Folks get annoyed. In fact, you write, quote, Philly, despite its self-professed, self-congratulatory, progressive label, they hate these brothers riding around like this. But you say it's genius, but it's also complicated. Explain that.
I do think it's genius. Look, you know, I've talked to a couple of these folks too. This is a city where, once again, like the downtown Center City corridor, there's been lots of things put in place that have made it harder for particularly young Black folks to spend time down here. On top of that, too, you know, you and I were talking about having our perspective being here in the early 2000s. I remember what it was like to have all the school closings, the library closings, the rec center closings. A lot of those still haven't been reopened, not to a proportionate way. And so you have all these services, you have all these activities and stuff, you have all these like infrastructure things that exist downtown, but not in the fringes of the city. And so I love that folks are using these dirt bikes to not just like show off, but to come back into the city. And again, like kind of like this is a way of accessing the city and bringing community with you. Like, I know the noise stuff, I know the like clogging the lanes and stuff, but if you literally stand and watch these people, it is caravans of folks laughing, smiling. Of course, there are a couple of times that there are things that go awry, but that does not define the whole. And I know the problem is often that, like, as soon as something bad happens and is associated with Black people, folks want to use it to define the whole. That is not the whole of this ATV dirt bike culture. Many of these folks are having fun, and they're they're forming community, which is a hard thing to do more and more nowadays in the city.
And those wheelies, you got to say, that is,
I mean, come on now.
Yeah. I mean, come on now. And even though it, people do see some issues with it, but I mean, if it wasn't downtown and if it was in an appropriate place, you would call it genius.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Or a different place.
You would call it a different place.
So what do you hope readers carry into their everyday lives after reading Black Genius?
I mean, I think the most important thing, especially nowadays, is that to do big, bold, loving things for your life, you don't have to do them alone. We have a culture that is very much telling people individual success is the only thing that matters. We're also losing third spaces. We're also losing just like the tissue of what it means to like have community every day with people. So the biggest thing I want people to take out of this, whether you're Black or non-Black, is the idea that if you want to do something meaningful and purposeful in your life, do it with other people.
Yeah, we need that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Trey Johnson, thank you so much for being in the studio.
This was so great. So great. Thank you so much.
That was author and cultural critic Trey Johnson. His book, Black Genius, Essays on an American Legacy, is out now. You can listen to Studio 2 live Monday through Thursday at noon on WHYY 90.9 FM. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Diana Martinez and Al Banks engineered the Studio 2 Extra. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.